Hello and welcome to End of Radio. This is episode 6. I'm your host, Joker. I'm here with UT Crazy and our very special guest today, Jason Scott.
Hello, very special episode.
It is.
Well, actually, might have some content for tonight for you, so.
Yeah.
Content's always good.
It is. Content is king.
Yeah, so this is the first time I've actually tried to conduct an interview or anything regarding with Skype. So it's a very interesting first time for everything. I have all your episodes of End If, but I haven't listened to any. I think I really ought to do that future, huh? Maybe in the future.
Yeah.
Before.
Oh, that's so good, because I deleted all the stuff off Hackamedia, and half of it I don't even have anymore. So I'm guessing that's the only archive we have.
So good, even the hosts don't listen to it. Excellent.
Yeah.
Well, all that's really important, I mean, is that you learn, one of the skills that people don't learn in tech and hackerdom is a lot of people have trouble communicating in medium other than online. And even online, perhaps they have some problems. So for me, it's really exciting to see people training themselves to speak, to listen, to conduct interviews, to ask questions, because it all works out for them later. You know, it's a skill set that you have later because you're always going to need to speak to people. And if you have a case where when you're talking to people and people hear in your voice that confidence and the practicedness, as opposed to spend all of his time with a machine until he's 18 and then he's suddenly in college having to speak and do things in front of other groups of people, and it sounds like he's never talked to a group of people before, it's a great skill set to learn. There's nothing but good in doing this kind
because,
of thing.
Because you can always know a lot about computers, know how to, like, help people with computers, I guess. But if you don't have any people skills, then you're not going to be able to help anyone to, be so...
Well, as a lot of your current generation and people who are trying to act like your generation like to say, it helps take it to the next level.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's one thing to have all these people who can understand information, but if they can't pass it to others in a way that makes others want to listen to them, then all they're doing is, you end up with something very similar to a Japanese cram school where people are just pulling in information enough to hold it long enough to get rid of it. Seems kind of a waste.
Yeah, you're just
so for me,
wasting time. Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of like my school. We just kind of learn for 10 weeks, write an essay, and then get everything after it.
Yes. And I should mention, being the inspiring role model for kids that I am, that I did very poorly in high school, and I did very poorly in college. So for me, it's academics never really worked out for me. And so I have people who are like, you're an archivist. You should get a degree in archiving. And I'm like, fight me. So that's generally what tends to happen is I say, well, that would require me to go to school. And I don't like going to school. You see, that's the big holdup in getting a degree is the part that you have to spend in school. So I had a degree in mass communications concentration in film. I didn't use for a while. Actually, if you're going to be weird about it, I did work in the video game industry. And as part of the video game industry, when I worked for Psygnosis, I was somebody who did some work doing demo movies. And so I guess I used my skill sets. Sort of. But anyway, yeah, so when I worked on this documentary, this BBS documentary, that was the first professional time that I spent using my degree, and that was 10 years after I graduated. So I guess it all comes back at some point, but it's never too late to use your degree, I suppose. I mean, I certainly had my money, but I worked in computers. Actually, I was a temp for many years because it was neat. You could go see a company, and if things sucked, you left. And it was nothing better than that. You didn't get paid as much, but there was that sense of, man, this place sucks, and you press the eject button and you go on to your next job, as opposed to most people where they're trapped or they convince themselves they're trapped. So I did temp agencies, and then I went into the video game industry for a couple of years until I was starving in that. And then I left that and went into hosting. I worked for a hosting company, and that hosting company has changed its name 12 times, and I still work for them. I still do work in hosting and taking care of people's computers and stuff, and so that's where I make my money. But my interest is obviously in history, and textfiles.com came about simply because I saw that there was this history of my childhood, BBS. Imagine 10 years from now, you go to look up stuff about hacker media that you were a part of, and you can't find anything, any mention of Stank. You can't find any mention of of BinRev or the Dog Pound, you can't find anything. Well, your first thought would be, well, I better go find my old hard drives, wherever they are, and maybe I can get some data off them and put them up. And that's basically what I did 7 years ago, was I had all this stuff from my childhood that I had when I was using computer bulletin boards that wasn't anywhere. And I thought, well, I've got that at home on my floppies. So I went home and got all my floppies from my dad's house and put them all online. And this was a revelation for certain people. They said, wow, this is great. And, you know, now that I know that somebody wants it, here's my collection. And so people started sending me their collections until it grew and grew, and now there's tens of thousands of these files. And there's a lot that I don't have, but there's a lot that I do. And you can't go crazy when you're building an archive over what you don't have. You go crazy making sure that what you do have can be reached easily and works and everything else, and that there won't be a chance of losing it again and so that. But people will go crazy. They'll say, well, I can only get 8 of the 10, and so I don't want to do it. And it's like, well, no, get the 8. Maybe somebody has the 10 that you don't know about. They won't know to look for it until that you're offering it. And that's the real secret with this kind of stuff. And so now people go, oh, so I can dump this crap. This guy will take it. He'll take anything. And that's my rule. People just send me printouts and discs and stories and write me or add data, and I just process it, bring it all in, gets bigger and bigger, and that's how it ends up becoming big. Textfiles.com is now getting about 250,000 people a month.
Oh my gosh.
People love visiting it. Now, they're visiting it for all sorts of different reasons. There's a extremely poorly written essay about koalas that's sitting in my uploads directory. Uploads is just stuff people contribute to me that's relatively new. It's my way of, you know, giving the people want to be a part of this, but their stuff isn't historical. So it's kind of like a little side display is this uploads directory where I say, well, here's stuff that was written in the last year. Give me stuff. Well, somebody sent me one about koalas that some kid typed in eighth grade in Pennsylvania, some school in Pennsylvania. And it's this horrible little story. It's really evil. It's supposed to be about why – you're supposed to write about why this endangered species is supposed to be saved. And no, they shouldn't be saved. Koalas should be wiped off the face of the earth, and here's why. And it's pretty funny, but for some reason, 8,000 people came last month to read it. I don't know why. It just spread like wildfire. Everyone said, you got to read the koala story, and everyone went and read the koala story. So I don't like to tell what textfiles.com is for anymore, because its original goal was, here's old files. But now people use it for – yeah, people just use it for whatever they want to, and that's fine with me. So I don't even tell people that it's for anything. I mostly collect anything historical I can find vaguely related to computers. You know. Yeah, in the last month, the number one file, 8,000 visitors for that file. Yeah, I wrote the guy. He was like, oh, you made my day. You know, he was really happy that that his little koala paper had... I don't know how this thing got out, but people just went crazy. They went for this koala paper. So you can...
Yeah.
It's just people spread word about it, and it just scatters everywhere. So anyway, yeah, so this whole textfiles.com thing was going very well. I was getting a name about it. You know, people were like, wow, it's the guy with the BBSs. And one day I got this really dumb idea in my head. And I do this sometimes. This is like my collect all the podcasts idea. You know, just what could possibly go wrong? I go ahead and just try something. So one of the things I tried was, since I have all these lists of old bulletin boards and with their numbers and where they're from, what if I wrote a program and wrote a way to extract all that information and put it all on a kind of a database kind of web page? So you could say, well, in area code 914, what boards were there and when were they up? And I was trying to figure out the problems in doing so. Where would I run into errors and stuff? And it was fun. And within like a week of playing with it, I had like 35,000 numbers because I just had all these old lists. And suddenly it was this big list, and it got slashdotted. And so everyone was hearing about it. And so people were sending me corrections. Well, no. I've been slashdotted about 6 times, and I learned how to deal with it.
Yeah.
The number one thing was...
So did you ever like die when that happened?
What ended up happening, well, I mean, the first time I got slashdotted, it was a 486, and it stayed up because it was all text. Second time, when I did the BBS list thing, it actually did die because I had made a mistake in how to do it, and I, in terms of, like, it was pushing out a lot of data. If you're what kills machines when they have this flash out problem is number of simultaneous connections. That's what kills it. It's never usage of the pipe. It's the machine gets 1,000 simultaneous requests. It's processing them, and that kills it. So, you know, if your system is a FreeBSD system that has good limits set on it and things, you can usually do a pretty good job of lasting against the slash routing, although you run slow. It's when slashdot links directly to an image, that's when you get crap. Because they'll link directly to E3, right? And everyone who's just kind of looking, because there's like a certain number of people from slash, this is what everyone needs if they ever get slashdotted. Slashdotters will hit a link, and they'll look at it, and then they'll make a decision. In doing that, they might decide not to go back. So the percentage of people who dig down into your site from slashdot is actually rather minimal. So what happens is if they link directly to an image or to an MP3 file or a large file, people who are just browsing will hit your site, go, oh, it's an MP3, I don't want an MP3. And there's thousands of them doing this. That's what kills these machines. The slashdot effect actually isn't so bad if you know how to plan for it. And that's what I did. I went off and got a web host specifically for high-level things. So I keep that around. That's like my my emergency boat. I give it a copy of a file, and I link to it, and I say, grab it from there. And it does it from there. So going back to, I guess, where I was, I got slashdotted with the BBS list thing. And it was interesting, and people thought it was interesting, and they sent me old lists, and it was growing like anything else. But what happened was that there was this whole other set of people who were remembering their past by these numbers. They would look at it and go, oh, I remember this place, I remember this place. And then there came what I call the club of nostalgia, which is what I have around me at all times. People go, oh, I remember this, let me tell you the story. And a lot of people were telling me the story. I mean, a lot of people. And so after like the first couple of hundred, I was like, wow, there's this whole story here, and I don't think it's been told properly. I think that somebody should tell it. Oh, I guess it's going to be me. So I went off and started researching, well, how would I do a film about bulletin boards? Because nobody had done one. And there were reasons why. It's because there aren't enough films of people dying or having sex using bulletin boards. So it's a very hard sell to people who are trying to get money. Because people, of course, you know, they try to get funding for their little problem. I didn't care about funding. I could afford it. So it was more about, could I make a story out of this? Could it be interesting? And so I put it together, and I started filming. And it was supposed to be filming for 1 year and editing for 6 months. And it ended up being shooting for 2.5 years and editing for a year. So it was bigger than I expected. It wasn't so bad in terms of budget. I don't think it didn't bankrupt me or anything. The film is actually a miniseries now. So what it is it's 8 episodes, range in size from 20 minutes to 50 minutes. So two of them are 20 minutes, a couple of them are 40 minutes, one of them is 50 minutes, and so on. So it's a huge different range, because the big problem when you tell a story that's 25 years in the making is that you end up having to shoehorn in things, and then nobody is tapped. The people that you're shoehorning the story in for don't get all the story they want, and the people who aren't interested in that part of the story are like, well, that's boring, let's go on to the next thing. You know, the people who are going to learn about Henry Ford and the assembly line of the 20s are not going to be people who want to hear about kids who are racing Dodge Neons that they're renting, you know, and they're all the story of the car. You know, how are you going to put the DeLorean next to the 50s? You know, it's after a while, people are like, well, get to the DeLorean part. What about the DeLorean part? And meanwhile, it's like, well, no, we have to go into this part. So I said, fine, screw it. Split it. The FidoNet story is a separate story. The hacker story is a separate story, and so on. Each kind of set of bulletin-like stories are their own thing. So let's see. Keep in mind, every time I list these episodes out, this should tell you how big this thing is. I always miss one. So let's see if I can do it this time. There's Vaud, which is the story of the early days of the BBS, and what came before it, the Telegraph, science fiction magazines, Plato system, and so on, that led to the bulletin board, and a quick story of both the beginnings of the bulletin board and the beginnings of the kids' bulletin boards 5 or 10 years later, both of which are kind of beginnings. Then there's SysOps and Users, which is basically a mosaic of people talking about bulletin boards as a memory. So it's kind of really a mishmash. There's over 130 people who appear in it in 40 minutes, so it's really quick. Lots of people talking. Then there's Art Scene, that's a scene of the early 1990s. There's Fido, which is the story of FidoNet, which was this large private network of bulletin boards that grew to tens of thousands of nodes around the world through the 80s and 90s. there's an episode called Make It A, which is about the bulletin board system industry, where you Wildcat and you had PC Board and Galacticom and all these companies, and you had magazines, Boardwatch, that were all trying to sell bulletin boards as a business, and how that didn't, how that conflicted with people. Let's see, what am I forgetting? There's No Carrier, which is the quote end of the VBS, where I cover why people left it, why they went to the, what it represented to them, and the sadness of that. HPAC is about more its hackers, the hacker ethic. The one which I suspect will be the one that will be the most copied and downloaded. let's see. In my mind, I'm looking at the menus trying to make sure I'm not forgetting any. There's Compression, which is a very unusual one. That tells the story of why we have the zip format as the predominant format for compression and the lives that were ruined as a result of it. So it's a very odd story.
Ruined.
I can hear you. I can hear typing. Somebody's cheating.
Yeah, I'm thinking of questions to ask you.
What do we say to you? What's going on with him? What's wrong with him? So let's see. So yeah, let's see if I got that right. So it's Bawd, Sysopsin Users, FidoNet, Art Scene, Make It Pay, Compression, ArcZip, and HPAC. So yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny when I show it to people, because I'll show them one or two episodes, and I'm like, well, that was fun. Now there's only six more for C. You know, I recommend the... No. Well, it depends. I find most people are good for about two episodes at a pinch. I mean, it's meant to be like an encyclopedia. It's meant to be like, you put it, you put it, you're like, I think I'll see this. There's been some talk, we've talked about maybe... making a schedule for people and saying, well, here's how you can spend a whole weekend, you know, immersing yourself in this. You know, on Friday, watch this episode with a fine wine and so on. But we'll see where that goes. You know, the episodes work out to about 5.5 hours combined. So it's a lot to process. Plus there's another hour and a half, roughly, of bonus footage, sequences that I thought slowed an episode down, but they were finished, so I put them in, or he told unusually interesting stories, and I wanted to put it somewhere, so they're in there. There's commentary track, but only a full commentary on two of the episodes. The others have 5 or 10 minute statements by me clarifying the episode, because, of course, you know, the problem is, or my problem, is I have chosen to make a documentary on some of the most obsessive-compulsive people on the face of the earth. So as a result, they're going to watch it, and they're going to go, but you didn't put this in, or you said this, but it was wrong, or what about this? You know, for instance, already people are going, HPAC, what happened to the V? You know, they're like, why didn't you cover virus writers? And I'm like, because virus writers were willing to come on camera. They don't generally like to talk to the press. And in fact,
viruses.
Yeah, viruses. Here's my name. Yeah, I'm having fun. There were a few people who contributed information, but they were not comfortable with going on camera. So instead of doing this thing with viruses and knowing I was going to get it all wrong, because the virus subculture is its own weird little story, I knew I was going to get that wrong. So I just avoided it completely. And so instead, I focused on hacking, freak, anarchy, and cracking. I don't cover carding, because not surprisingly, nobody wanted to go on about that either. And it's an interesting little episode. Now, in terms of people copying it, I should mention that all of these episodes are released Creative Commons Attribute Share Alike 2.0. So basically that means you can rip, mix, and copy, sell, or otherwise do whatever you want to with these things, with no limits, and whatever you create, put out, whatever, has to have the same license. You can't take it. You can take it and sell it. Have a grand old time, but
give
you have to sell it in the...
Just give attribution, like say, oh, Jason Scott made this, so...
Yep. I stole this from Jason Scott. Jason Scott made no money from this. But even beyond that, Jason Scott can then take it and sell it again. You know, in other words, I could take your reduced version and go, here you go, somebody made a reduced version and I'm selling it for whatever. But, you know, because this DVD set okay, and it's a 3-DVD set with a full-color box and art and everything else, is $50. And that cuts out a certain number of people. And there's not much I could do about that. I mean, it's a full-on product. And for people who want to see it, they're going to see it, right? And I don't mean, like, from my encouraging them. I mean, if I was to go ahead and slap copy protection on this thing, which I didn't, or put mass revision on it, which I didn't, right, they'll get copies of it anyway because they want to see it. So why should I sit there and say, you know, oh, that's not right. How dare you? And it's like, well, you know, I'm definitely of the school that, with a few exceptions, the vast majority of people who duplicate products are not generally in the business of those products. In other words, I don't think that, like, if I think somebody gets a copy of my DVDs, they probably weren't going to buy a copy. Now, they might see it and go, yeah, I want a copy. And I mean, I'll sign them and I'll do whatever else people want, you know, to make it worth their while. And people have done things like that, and I'm signing hundreds of these copies. But if people don't see a value in it, if they don't see a value in owning the DVD itself or giving me money, they should still at least learn about bulletin boards, which is why I did it. You know, it's more important to me that people learn about these things than anything else. You know, I don't look at this thing as a product. It'll make me money. Maybe, probably, hopefully, but it's not why I did it. If I was doing it to make money, I would have shot it across 3 months and edited it in 1 month and gotten it out there.
Yeah.
I would have pre-sold it to Discovery or something. That wasn't what this was about. This was about how much could I learn by traveling around. And it benefited me as a person because I traveled to places I'd never been and talked to people I would have never known any other way. And I just came into their house and just started asking them questions with a camera. And so there is a wide variety of people. This isn't all names. You know, often in a documentary you'll have people who are like, you know, oh, this guy was, you know, he invented the nose-picking machine, and so we go interview him for a while. He's so important. You can't tell the story of the nose without this man. Well, with my stuff, I wanted just people who happened to use it, because I think that was what bulletin boards was. And that was a very interesting gamble. That meant that I did 201 interviews. So there were a lot of interviews, as opposed to, say, 10, which would be your average document. So, thousands of miles. I think that there was, there's a couple trips where I'm really particularly famous for, because I landed in San Francisco, drove down to Palm Springs, then drove up to Seattle, and then back to San Francisco, all within the scope of about 8 days. So I was traveling an average of 200 to 300 miles a day interviewing people. I did the same thing in the Midwest. I landed in Chicago, did a little stopover in Indianapolis, then drove up to Milwaukee, over to Minneapolis, down to St. Louis, over to Kansas, down to Oklahoma, down into Texas, and then flew out of Texas because I was a one-man crew, and it was the only way to interview people was to say, okay, well, I'll be in Kansas on Tuesday, and I'll be in Oklahoma, and where do I have to go between them, and so on. And so the record was I drove 1,000 miles for a single interview. But it was a really good interview. I was in Colorado interviewing people, and I got a lead on that I could interview one of the creators of PC board software in Utah. So I was like, okay, I guess I'm going to Utah. I really didn't comprehend how far that was. So I drove all the way through Wyoming, and that was 500 miles of nothing, flat out nothing. I started using the rumble strips as a snare, so I could just kind of nod off until I heard the rumble strip. Because I was, you know, I mean, I did one day, so it was 1,000 miles in a single day, and no person should do that.
You
That's
could listen
not
to a few radio shows in a day.
Well, what you end up doing, you couldn't do that because I'm driving so fast, I'm not getting radio station reception. So what I would actually do during the Midwest trip was I loaded Radio Freak America into a CD MP3 player and played that the whole way. So I listened to a lot of episodes of Dual Parallel.
Yeah.
A lot of episodes. Boy. So that's how I started to really get, like, enjoy this whole hacker radio thing. Was, wow, this is interesting, and I'm learning so much, and so on. I mean, I agree with a third of what Radio Freak America said in its run. I mean, I listened to it, and I agree with maybe a third. But that's not the point. The point is not for you to agree, and, you know, otherwise you've just got what? You've got a syncophant broadcast. You're listening to people telling you what you already know and strengthening. That's just not cool. I'd much rather have somebody who says things, and I'm like, I don't agree with that. But why don't I agree with that? What's wrong with it? Why do I not like it that he's saying this? And then I think about it, and I'm like, oh, it's because of this opinion, which I didn't know I had. And I have to think about it, why I chose that, and so on. And that's where you start to think, and you start to look into the world around you, and you start to treat the world a little differently because now you start to understand. And one of the skill sets that I picked up in this interview thing, which, of course, I'm not demonstrating right now, is the ability to listen. I was able to listen to people much better now. I could, you know, I was asking people questions, and you have to sit when you're interviewing somebody, because if you've got three questions in your head, and the three questions are, you know, where did you meet your wife, how are you two, you know, how happy are you two, and where do you think you guys are going to be in 10 years? And if after the first question, the guy answers, oh, my wife just left me. Well,
yeah.
Your other two questions aren't very good. And you've got, there are interviewers who will just freaking barrel through and ask the second two questions, because those are the two that are on the list. And you got to listen. When a person says, well, I don't really agree with that, what they're really saying is, I want to tell you why I don't agree with that. So then you say, well, why don't you agree with that? It sounds reasonable. And they go, well, this is the reason why. Now you have an interview and now you have input. I generated 250 hours of interview footage, and all of it, with little exception, is going on archive.org. So people will be able to go, well, I really like that one guy who's on for 15 seconds in the documentary. I'd like to hear him for an hour. Well, they can. They'll be able to hear everything this person had to say. A lot of people said redundant things, you know. I'd start them off talking about bulletin boards, and they would say a lot of the same things, and then they would say something that was unusual for them, and then I would go there. So a lot of that is edited out, but for a person, you get a whole kind of oral history of that person's life in these interviews. So I'm fully expecting to put all of them on, with the exception of, you know, sequences where they're like, I don't understand this, and I don't understand where the camera is, and how do I do this, and I have to use the bathroom. That stuff will be cut out. But all the rest of it, question, answer, question, answer. So, no, this project will actually generate an enormous amount of data for the world, so it's useful in that way. All right, so hit me up with mini-DV. Use the Canon XL1, XL1S. That's a mini DV camera with a really nice lens. People are lucky now. In the last year, four of the five companies that make video cameras that are of any size, that is to say Canon, Panasonic? Either Panasonic or JVC told the others to go screw. I think it was Panasonic. But, you know, basically Sony, Canon, Nikon, they've all gotten together and they've agreed on a new format called HDV. And HDV is high definition video that fits on a mini DV cassette. And what this has done is this has taken cameras that used to be $60,000 and made it so they're $3,000. And
how much did
you
pay for that camera?
I paid $4,000 in 2001 for my camera. Well, the XL1S came out, and the XL2 came out, and I think the XL2S maybe well, certainly, my camera is an ancient, unusable piece of crap now in the 4 years it's been used. Still films good.
Let's see. Oh, yeah.
Be sure to cut that pause out, by the way. Okay.
Yeah.
And cut this part out. And this part, too.
Oh, yeah. Okay. What did you use to edit it?
I used what at the time was known as Vegas Video 4.0, and then I switched to 5.0. Between 4.0 and 5.0, they were purchased by Sony. So they became Sony Vegas. So now it's called Sony Vegas. Basically, it's by the same guys who did the Acid music mixing program, which a lot of people know. Basically, Vegas Video, I tried a bunch. Basically, it's technology is going on. People have to understand that a lot of the processes that make something good or bad are optimized. That's what programmers do, and what I'm explaining here is for everything that has complicated software, the next generation of software is cheaper, faster, and does the process better. People have to realize that. So morphing software, which used to be unbelievably expensive and hand-intensive, make work, now is like throwing four fun plug-in in paint programs now. Because that's what happened. They're not worse. They're better. They're better morphing programs. Editing is much the same way. Over time, more and more people are making editing software, and it's pretty darn good. In the editing world, Avid is kind of the king of editing software, and Avid looks down its nose at people who use Adobe Premiere Pro, I think it's Premiere Pro, Premiere, they look down on them. But then Premiere people down on the Vegas people, and that's where I am. And we look down our nose at the Pinnacle people. And the Pinnacle people, I don't know what they do. I think they don't actually have anyone look. They look iMovie. They look down. Actually, iMovie's pretty good, isn't it?
iMovie Everyone says iMovie is good. I don't know.
It depends on what you need to do. If all you're doing, right, is you've got a linear set of events that occur and you wish to take pieces of it and put them in order, a lot of editing software is just what you need. Now, there was a lot of stuff in my editing. There were effects that I needed to do. For instance, one thing I did was I boom mics, and that required a certain amount of editing power to do it. One of the episodes, Artsy, has six tracks of stuff going on. So there's stuff scrolling by while the person is talking, and you can see other things behind that thing scrolling by, and things fading in and out. It's very complicated. So I was finding it unbelievably easy to use. I tried Premiere, I tried Pinnacle, and I tried Vegas, and for whatever reason, my own personal thing, just like people prefer Word over OpenOffice or over, you know, WordPerfect or whatever else they have out there now, I just found my mind worked well with Vegas Video. And it wasn't that expensive per se. It was like I bought it by forcing my cousin who was in college to give me a photocopy of his ID, so I bought it with a student discount. But the student discount was like $300, so it wasn't so bad. I always buy on student. As they say, as I think it was one of my mentors taught me, you are a student until you die. You are always a student. So when they ask, are you a student? Do you want a student discount? You go, yes, I am continually learning. Anyway, so yeah, I spent like $300 for Vegas Video. And it was well worth it. I made it a personal point that I purchased every piece of software that I used in the production. I thought that, you know,
it's, you know,
after years and years of half-decade trial periods, it was time to, like, buy what I was using. I was going to make it, I was going to sell it. So I ended up buying that, and I bought a horrible DVD mastering program, which I will not give the name of, which didn't work as well as I would have liked, and actually it cost me a bit of money to deal with it. I spent $17.50 I didn't want to have to spend. Anyway, but the Vegas Video stuff was, I mean, I was doing work for the documentary, and I've edited 5.5 hours of footage in it. So it works. And if it doesn't work, and I still use it. I still do things with it. I went to a couple demo parties and videotaped them and used Vegas Video to edit it. And I can edit stuff real quick now, I'll tell you that. There's one thing I can do now. It's friggin' edit.
Yeah, after doing a half year of editing. Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. Tens of thousands of cuts.
So my other question is, did this whole thing cost? And because were you working? I'm assuming you were. You were doing all this. And also, how much does it cost to make each one for you?
Each one?
Each, VBS documentary, like, copy.
Oh.
Like, burning, okay, and stuff like that. Yeah.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah. Well, it's easier to go with the big numbers, which is, I'm still working it out with the receipts. I believe I spent $25,000 to make the documentary. I'm not sure, though. We're still working out the numbers. I'm pretty sure it's somewhere in that range, though. I think it's in the $20,000 to $25,000 range. It's cost me $30,000 on top of that to make the DVDs because of the process.
Yeah.
So the whole thing's been about $50,000, which isn't so bad. I do have a day job. That's everything.
Yeah.
Everything. That's plane trips. That's meals.
Think of it as a vacation too. You get a BBS documentary and the vacation.
Well, kind of. The first Texas trip, I was there for 4 days, interviewed six sets of people. A little more than six people. But I remember that because the first night I slept for 3 hours, and the second night I slept for two, and the last one I slept for one. I spent most of the time on the road. I thought that it would be more of a vacation, but it really wasn't. When I go, I don't know. I don't have any real vision of the distances. I just go, oh, here's somebody in Hoppertown. And after I'm done in Hoppertown, oh, I'll go over here to Oreoville and, you know, whatever. And I don't really fathom that Oreoville and Hoppertown are 200 miles from each other. Yeah. You know, it's like the equivalent of, like, I'll interview somebody in Boston today, and then later today I'll interview somebody in New York, you know, or Baltimore and New York, or depending on where people are located, you know, San Francisco and Los Angeles. I certainly did that a couple times where I interviewed one person in San Francisco and then drove down, interviewed somebody in San Luis Obispo, and then interviewed somebody in Los Angeles night. That was dumb, but I did a lot of that, so I didn't enjoy it as much as I would have liked. But it was money well spent. I mean, I went to 9 or 10 states that I would have never gone to. You know, yeah. People build up these things in their mind. I thought of Texas as this scary place where they executed everybody and everyone had guns and so on. You know, just build up this stupid media vision of where a place is. And I went there and was not shot at once, had a great time, got to see the... No, I wasn't shot at. That's the thing. It was nothing like this stupid image I built up in my mind because of whatever, you know? I mean, that's where you get people who say stupid things like the term flyover state, you know, that the term used by people who live on coast, and they refer to the states in the Midwest as the flyover states, as in, I would never want to go through those. Those are below me because I am of the coast. That kind of stupidity, it's flat-out stupidity. I have never seen this thing. I have never been to this thing. But I have read a bunch of stories in the same magazines that I know lie to me all the time, and so I have decided that's what it's like, and I go there. That's pretty much, that puts you up around the intelligence and social awareness of a house cat. You know, I mean, forget it. So it was nice to break through that, to actually go to Wyoming, to go to Utah, to go to Texas, to... you know, Nevada, other parts of Nevada besides Las Vegas, because I've been to Las Vegas a bunch of times and so on, and see these places. And so that was worth it in pay right there. I'm already at a profit just for having all that. So, you know, probably make the money back for this documentary. I'm not concerned too much about it. I'm selling it to libraries. I'm selling it to other groups. I suspect, you know, it's a good movie. I mean, it's like I watch them now, fun. I pop them in every once in a while and kind of look at them. I have the prototype DVD sitting here. And I put them in. I'll be like, oh, that's a pretty good episode. You know, some of them wear on me after the – some of these I've seen over 200 times now, so they're starting to wear on me. A couple of them I'm like, okay, I know this part. But they're still pretty good, so I suspect they'll sell well. I hope they sell well. I encourage people to buy them. I'll sign them if they buy them. You know, it'll be a solid thing, you know. And it's unique. Part of why I think it's a fun thing is that it's the only bulletin board system documentary. It may end up becoming the only one. I hope not. I hope other people take it and do things with it, but I haven't seen that yet.
Mm-hmm. So my last question is, how many mini DV tapes did you use to film all this?
260. Well,
I was thinking.
Hell yeah. I went to tapeandvideo.com, something like these things where you're like, I want a Snoopy doll. I'll go to snoopydoll.com and it has it, kind of a deal. It was like that, like tapefilm.com or videotape.com, and they were selling 100 tape bulk for like $35 to $40, so it worked out for $3 a tape. And then that was the other thing. I intended to film on film. I knew that filming on film was a no start. No point. And it made it much easier when I interviewed people, because I would say to them, look, understand, it costs me $3 to interview for an hour. I spent more in gas coming from the hotel to interview you.
Yeah.
So let's just do it at whatever speed you're comfortable with. And that relaxed a lot of people. They didn't feel the pressure of, here's the five questions. We have to ask you the five questions. You know, I like to just ask people stuff, because that's where the real, what would happen is that the person go, yeah, I told you everything. Oh, wait, did I tell you about the time that somebody I knew died on a bulletin board? And I go, what? And then they could go tell me this incredible story. You know, that happened a lot. And if I was running on film, I would only have certain amounts of minutes. It would cost me $5 or $10 a minute. That's why these movies cost so much, you know, to film people. By doing it on video, it looks a little crappier, but it's actually pretty good looking. And like I said, this new HDV thing, now you get high definition for the price of regular DV tape. Can't ask for better.
Yeah.
So if I ever do another, another documentary, I would shoot it in high definition.
Yeah.
Without a doubt. Now it's so cheap. That's why I bought that camera. It was the nicest camera I could get for less than $20,000. That's why I chose it. It was everybody who interviewed. If you read enough reviews of any piece of equipment, eventually they'll go right down the middle. Half the people will love it and half the people will hate it. But you try to look for what everyone says. So the ones that hated it were like, yes, given that the sound and the video were perfect on this thing, I had problems with this, this, and this. And everyone would say that. Oh, I love this thing. The sound and video is great. And so eventually I just said, okay, well, let's get this for the sound and the video, and I'll deal with the negatives. And that's what happened. I didn't actually run into too many negatives with it. I don't think if there's anything. I made some mistakes with the sound recording. I used a very unusual sound recording system, and it added a noise floor that I wasn't comfortable with. But it was otherwise pretty good. I started out with an on-camera mic because I couldn't afford a boom yet because I was piecing this out otherwise. But I switched to a boom, and I paid a price for that by not using lavaliers. I definitely, in some cases, got really good footage. Problem was like I said, there was a noise floor that I would have liked. And that was purely a product of the camera's... I had a Phantom Power, a 48, an XLR, basically, an XLR adapter. The newer versions of this camera have an XLR adapter built right in. But I had to buy the XLR breakout box, basically. And guess what? It sucks. It added a noise floor. People talked too quietly. I couldn't get rid of the noise floor. So there's a couple interviews where I had to do some real major audio trickery to get it back to something normal. Meanwhile, it sounded as good as something you'd hear on 2020. So it was very frustrating. You know, across 3 years, you get this wide variance. People commented about that, how some of the footage was a lot different. The answer is, well, sometimes it was shot in somebody's house, sometimes it was shot at a hotel, sometimes it was shot at a convention. Very random. And so some people, just it all worked out great. Other people, not so great. But I did my best and cut them all together and did things to get around that problem. You know, there's a lot of editing tricks. A lot of editing tricks. And that's part of why it was good to work in the software. I had what I called my intelligence booster. I would make people sound smarter by cutting away, cutting out their pauses or misstatements and stuff. So people sound better than they are.
That's what you have to do, Joker. When we're sounding stupid, we'll just cut that out. Yeah.
Hey, you want a secret? Because I know he'll love me telling people this. Radman, who does the Art Scene Radio talk show.
Yeah.
He edits for pauses. Actually, I might add, so does NPR. When you hear an interview on NPR, they have programs that cut out any pauses, delays, statements that are in there so that people sound better. Yeah. They all do that. They all do that. And so people, when people listen to things like that, the thing you have to understand is how much of a construct these professional television and radio programs are, how much of it has been edited, how much work has been done to make people sound better. And then people come up trying to sound as good as it, and they don't realize that they're up against thousands of dollars and many hours of work that are being done by full-time paid people. You know, yeah, great. You get like a Trading Spaces, but they don't realize that a Trading Spaces is like 60 hours of footage cut down to an hour. And that sometimes they'll do multiple takes, and they'll try different angles, and they'll write stuff for the people sometimes. Like, they'll give the people who are the homeowner something to say. Like, we're really proud of this place. We've been at it for a long, long time. You know, they'll give them things to say so that these people don't sound like morons.
There's no real reality TV.
No, there isn't. And certainly you have a case where you have these hacker radio shows where people turn on the camera or turn on the microphone and they talk for a straight hour and they're wondering why it doesn't sound as good as a television or radio show.
Yeah, they don't spend like 4 hours editing.
I mean, right. Yeah, except for me. But, I mean, for me, it's a matter of misaligned priorities, really. I'm spending the money. I don't have kids, thank goodness. And so as a result, the money that I'd be spending because Junior decided he was going to wrap my car around a pole, I'm spending on microphones and audio equipment and computer equipment and disk drives and so on.
And BBS documentaries.
And BBS and the occasional five-hour documentary, yes.
Yeah. So, there's not a lot of things I can say this for, but I think I actually might buy this. Not just, like, go on BitTorrent and get it. So, you should be kind of proud of that. You've convinced me.
Well, I mean, I don't want people to, you know, be not eating to see this.
Yeah. I don't think those guys saying, well, we work on the scene and we're in the background and we need this money, like in the movie theaters, the MPAA. That doesn't convince me to do it, so I don't
know. This is definitely a one-man production.
Yeah.
Doesn't look like it. My goal at the time was, since my budget is less than a week's food budget for a regular movie, I knew that I couldn't make things great, but I said I wanted to get between 80 or 90% of the feel. And it's pretty far up there. There's a couple pieces where I'm like, I could have shot that better, I could have shot this better. But that's because I'm forgetting that I had just driven 300 miles and the person moved us to a different room and I was trying to adjust to the room and deal with the sound of cars outside and everything else. So, I mean, it's one of those deals. But you watch it, and I don't know. I think you get pulled in pretty quickly. I think people will like it. I think the cool part about doing it myself is I answer only to myself. So if somebody doesn't like a choice that I made, it's my choice. I made it. I didn't make it because my producers told me to do it. I didn't do it because I thought it wouldn't sell. You know, there's nothing in here where I'm like, oh, this will. You know, I can't put that in. That's too controversial, or that's too hard for people to understand. It's got to be designed so it can play in an airplane. nothing like that. No, I didn't shoot it with the framing so that it would work best in this certain kind of condition and so on. Very specifically, you know, they shoot movies so that you can leave and get popcorn and come back and not miss too much. You know, guys blowing crap up. You go out and get your popcorn, you come back, he's blowing other crap up. And you're like, oh, I guess he's still alive and still blowing crap up. I get it.
not much change.
Yeah, no, so when people come after me, and I know they will, because there's a lot of statements and things and stuff, I'll be able to say, well, I made that choice because of A, B, and C. Pro or con, this was a choice that I made. And they can say, well, I don't agree with it. And I'm like, well, I don't say make your own movie again now because, of course, I'll be releasing all the footage. And people can say, I can say, well, I can't wait to see yours. Here's 200 hours. Can't wait to see it. I hope people – the most common complaint that I've encountered so far – and keep in mind the movie's not out, so the reviews have been kind of weird. But the most common complaint is – the focus on North American bulletin board stories. That's a problem for people who aren't in North America who expect it to be worldwide. And the answer was, I didn't think I would do a very good job at it. I thought I wouldn't be very good. I don't speak other languages very well. I have never been to Europe. I'm hoping to change that, but I've never been. It would be a really bad idea for that to be my first trip. It's with a camera randomly driving throughout the European countryside and the Asian countryside and the African countryside trying to get a view. Come on, those are films in themselves. And so I'm hoping people from that country will go, you know, he screwed up. Why didn't he cover, you know, the Euro scene? And the answer is, well, here's 200 hours. Use it and then build on it with your own and cover the Euro scene. So I'm hoping that people do that. We'll see. I'm going to probably rent a theater here in Boston, which is where I live, and show a little – but, I mean, you can't show all 5.5 hours. You'll kill everybody. So, you know, the Bladder Buster 5000. I went to see Trilogy Tuesday, which was the Lord of the Rings, where they showed the extended of the first one, the extended of the second one, and then they showed the third movie on its premiere night. I forget how much that cost me. It was like $25 or something. It was worth it, but it was 11 friggin' hours. And the joke my friend used to say was, when you bought a soda, they give you two cups. You know, they give you the full one and the empty one. You'll be filling later. Yeah. I couldn't do that to people. So generally, I like to show them Bawd. I find if I had to choose two for people to see, it's either Bawd and Art Scene or Bawd and the Hacker one. Those tend to like summarize it for what a lot of people want. Make It Pay is really kind of fun in its own way. I have to stress that none of these look like the others. They all have their own personalities. They all have their own approach. They seem not like clones, but they seem like siblings. You know, they're into each other, but their look, their feel is very different from film to film. There's some quote-unquote Jason styles, as I have now discovered. You know, one of the things I was excited about was, I've never seen a full-length Jason Scott movie. I wonder what it's like. I wonder if it's any good. And I realized very quickly things that I liked to do that were me. So that's been kind of exciting in its own strange way. There's an editing sequence that I caught myself doing 10 or 15 times through the films of like, you know, this was how I built up a story. And I was like, wow, I do that. That's me. That's how I tell the story. And I can't really trace it to me, so it's kind of just mine. I'm really proud about that, so that there's actual personality of my own. But, you know, the Art Scene one is very weird and full of lots of graphics and everything, and the Hacker one is more mellow. The Fidonet one has, like, audio that's, like, acoustic guitars playing around, people talking, freeze frames. They've all got different personalities. So I probably put together a show. I'm certainly going to try to go to festivals, and I'll send them a copy of the DVD and see if they want me to come. You know, since I'm already selling it, I don't really have to get a distribution deal. I kind of don't want a distribution deal. I'm selling through Amazon, and I'm selling on my site. I recommend everybody buy through my site. A, it'll be cheaper, and B, I'll make more money. I think what people don't realize is that Amazon takes 55% of the price.
Are you kidding me?
When they sell. Yeah, if you sell through Amazon, they take 55% of the cost. That's flat out.
So are you selling it yet, or what?
Oh, I'm certainly selling it. You just won't get one in your mailbox yet.
So they're just pre-orders right now?
Like it's all pre-sale. The third disc is about approved. What that means is that they're running it through the factory. They send me a copy of it as printed by the machine, and if I say it's good, then they go ahead and print thousands of copies of it. Everything else is basically done, and once they start printing, the first few hundred are to be sent to me immediately, and then the thousands that come afterwards are to be mailed to me separately, so that way I can get the pre-orders out and really start promoting and pushing this. I'm not comfortable promoting this too much until when you buy it, one comes in the mail as soon as your money arrives. I did some pre-sales because there was some belief on the part of parts of my family that this could not possibly be a profitable venture and would eventually cause me to go bankrupt. But as people, and so what I said to people, very supportive. family comes from finance, so they know, right? They look at things and they know wishes don't add to the bottom line. So they're like, prove it. I was like, fine. I put it up for pre-sale, and what I offered to the people for the first month was, if you order it and you give me a paragraph of text, I will put that in the DVD. And about 300 people went for that. So there's 300 paragraphs or so on the DVD, the DVD-ROM section of one of them. So you get this whole collection of writings from people about why they like BBSs and why they're happy and so on. So that's on there. So that's kind of a neat, weird way of stuff things, and I guess it's kind of an anti-piracy move, though not really. You know, theory is pay it ahead of time, and you get to become part of the project. That's part of the theory. Mm-hmm. So your show is now at 1 hour. Do you have any other questions?
Yep. Same here.
Yep. A very good show. Jason Scott talks endlessly for 1 hour while two other guys go, yep, he's still talking.
It was interesting for me. Because I didn't know that much at the starting. So thank you very much.
No problem. I'm more than willing to talk about this and any other subjects at length. I actually just recently finished a project for a convention called Nauticon, which I created there called Nauticon Radio. And at nauticonradio.org/radio, and I'm probably adding the link tonight, is something on the order of 20 hours of recorded show. And it's not all me, but it's a lot of me. And it's just us talking. And we broadcast around the hotel and eventually to the internet at large about halfway through. Drew Curtis is of Park.com. Steph the Geek of StephTheGeek.com shows up at one point. Radman of Acid Production shows up. Wide variety of people show up on tape. I'm not on there half the time. Half the time, other people took the radio station over, so it's really kind of interesting to listen to. It's a real major rant fest.
So do you broadcast with FM, or what did you
purely icecast it. We icecast it over the local hotel network, and we had a link out to a megabit line out in Michigan, so people were able to listen to it on the internet at large. And we had an IRC tell up. People were able to ask us questions, and we'd respond to it. And that's when we found out there was a 45-second pause between when the icecast would broadcast it and when people would be able to hear it, because we'd see these responses from people to things a minute or 2 minutes before. It was really kind of surreal how the whole thing works. So anyway, that was a big
into the Duels of Dork 4 hours of that Duels of Dork radio.
the best sequence in there is the 1 megabyte file that says I believe it's Citadel replaces a fuse, which is like the fourth or fifth one. He blew a fuse. And so he soldered in a wire
to replace the
fuse. And he's like, I don't know what's going to happen. And we're talking, and in the background, you just hear, scream. It's beautiful. It's a piece of history. You hear somebody blow up a computer by mistake in the middle of a show. It was just a great moment. So I separated it off, so it was only a 1 meg download. Yeah. And we're just like, he's going to blow so much. And then you hear a little frazz. So, all right. It was great radio, as they say. So there you go.
Did you want to pick a song for the outro?
Me pick a song? Oh, no, you pick the song. You make the song whatever you want it to be. Use some good Creative Commons music. Vast majority of, well, pretty much all the music in my documentary is Creative Commons music from opsound.com.
There's some pretty good PodSafe music. Like, Creative Commons license, and they'll say...
I mean, make no mistake, when it is crap, it is truly and honestly crap. You can't get that bad, normally. Like, commercial radio does not provide levels of bad like you get on some of these. But when it's good, it's indistinguishable from full professional music. It's beautiful. It's one of those things. It's like anything else, right? The law that said 90% of all science fiction was crap, and then there was a second law that came out that said, well, really, 90% of everything is crap. You've got to wade through a lot of stuff to find the quality. But there's some really good music out there.
If you find it.
If you know where to find it. Oh, thank goodness for podcasting.
Yeah. So do you want to finish up the show, Joker? Have a little...
Well, you guys don't get to hear my great outro here, because I didn't record it right, but you don't get to hear the end of the conversation either after the show, but I'll give you a little hint at the outro song, which is the Jewish rap, and I hope you enjoyed the show, and I'm doing better shows than this, and we kept getting better than this, and hopefully we're going to be back for a while, so just wait for us, and we'll see what we're going to do, and that's the end.
Alright already.
The
my name is Ira and my middle name is Saul. And the girls don't like me because my schmeckle is so small. I got a circumcision by a member of the cloth. The rabbi had a special, he took 50% off.
Oi!
What's the matter?
I think I broke my matzo balls.
On my head I wear a yarmulke, you recognize, I hope. I wear it every time I pray, I look just like the Pope. I got a big nose and it looks kinda funny, but it really comes in handy, cause it's where I hide my money.
You should be so lucky. It's so hot in here, I'm spitzing.
Well, I wanna be a lawyer, so you know I won't be poor. But if I fail the bar exam, I'll open up a store. I'll never pay retail, I'll wait till there's a sale. My wife won't clip the coupons,
cause I might break a nail. You never take me anywhere. Never in my life.
Honey, what'd you make for dinner?
Reservation. A raider ready. A raider ready.
A raider ready.
A raider ready.
A raider ready.
A raider ready.
A raider ready.
My name is Ira and my middle name is Saul. And the girls don't like me cause my schmeckle is so small. I got a circumcision by a member of the cloth. The rabbi had a special, he took 10% off.
Oi!
What's the matter?
I think I broke my matzo balls.
On my head I wear a yarmulke, you recognize, I hope. I wear it every time I pray, I look just like the Pope. I got a big nose and it looks kinda funny, but it really comes in handy cause it's where I hide my money.
Lucky. It's so hot in here, I'm spitzing.
Well, I wanna be a lawyer, so you know I won't be poor. But if I fail the bar exam, I'll open up a store. I'll never pay retail, I'll wait till there's a sale. My wife won't clip the coupons,
cause I might break a nail. You never take me anywhere. Never in my life.
Honey, what'd you make for dinner?
Reservation. A raider ready.